Welcome to a reading of John Calvin's commentary on Genesis. This Reformation MP3 audio resource is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. Many free Reformation resources, as well as our complete online catalogue, containing classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, the Puritan hard drive, digital downloads, MP3s, DVDs, and much more at great discounts, are on the web at www.puritandownloads.com. Also, please consider, pray and act upon the important truths found in the following quotation by Charles Spurgeon. As the Apostle says to Timothy, so also he says to everyone, give yourself to reading. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read. Renounce as much as you will all like literature, but study as much as possible sound theological works, especially the Puritanic writers and expositions of the Bible. The best way for you to spend your leisure is to be either reading or praying. And now to SWRB's reading of Calvin's commentary on Genesis, which we hope you find to be a great blessing, and which we pray draws you nearer to the Lord Jesus Christ. For he is the way, the truth, and the life, and no man cometh unto the Father but by him. John 14, verse 6. I'm reading from page 698. Verse 16. And the fame thereof was heard in Pharaoh's house. What Moses now relates was prior in the order of events. For before Joseph sent for his father, the report of the coming of his brethren had reached the palace. And Joseph would not have promised so confidently a home to his brethren in Egypt, except by the king's permission. What therefore Moses had before briefly alluded to, he now fully explains, namely, that the king, with a ready and cheerful mind, declared his high esteem for Joseph, in freely offering to his father and brethren the most fertile part of Egypt for their dwelling. And from another statement of Moses, it appears that as long as he lived, the Israelites were treated with clemency and kindness. For in Exodus 1 verse 8, the commencement of the tyranny and cruelty is said to have been made by his successor, to whom Joseph was unknown. Verse 22. And to all of them he gave each man changes of raiment. That he furnishes his brethren with supplies for their journey is not wonderful, but to what purpose was it that he loaded them with money and garments, seeing they would so soon return? I indeed do not doubt that he did it on account of his father and the wives of his brethren, in order that they might have less reluctance to leave the land of Canaan. For he knew that his message would scarcely be believed unless some manifest tokens of its truth were presented. It might also be that he not only endeavoured to allure those who were absent, but that he also wished to testify more and more his love towards his brethren. But the former consideration has more weight with me, because he took greater care in furnishing Benjamin than the rest. Jerome has translated the expression changes of raiment by two robes, and other interpreters following him expounded as meaning different kinds of raiment, garments. I know not whether this be solid. I rather suppose they were elegant garments, such as were used at nuptials and on festal days, for I think that constant custom was silently opposed to this variety of dress. Verse 24. See that ye fall not out by the way. Some explain the passage as meaning that Joseph asked his brethren to be of tranquil mind and not to disturb themselves with needless fear. He rather exhorts them, however, to mutual peace. For the word ragaz sometimes signifies to tremble or be afraid, and sometimes to make a tumult. The latter sense is the more appropriate, for we know that the children of God are not only easily appeased if anyone has injured them, but they also desire others should live together in a concord. Joseph was pacified towards his brethren. But at the same time, he admonished them not to stir up any strife among themselves. For there was reason to fear lest each, in attempting to excuse himself, should try to lay the blame on others, and this contention would arise. We ought to imitate the kindness of Joseph, that we may prevent, as much as possible, quarrels and strifes of words. For Christ requires of his disciples not only that they should be lovers of peace, but also that they should be peacemakers. Wherefore it is our duty to remove, in time, all matter and occasion of strife. Besides, we must know that what Joseph taught his brethren is the command of the Spirit of God to us all, namely, that we should not be angry with each other, and because it generally happens that, in faults common to different parties, one maliciously accuses another. Let each of us learn to acknowledge and confess his own fault, lest altercation should end in combats. Verse 26. And Jacob's heart fainted. We know that some persons have fainted with sudden and unexpected joy. Therefore, certain interpreters suppose that the heart of Jacob was, in a sense, suffocated, as if seized by an ecstatic stupor. But Moses assigns a different cause, namely that not having confidence in his sons, he was agitated between hope and fear. And we know that they who are held in suspense by hearing some incredible message are struck with torpor, as if they were lifeless. It was not, therefore, a simple affection of joy, but a certain mingled perturbation which shook the mind of Jacob. Therefore Moses shortly after says that his spirit revived, when he, having returned to himself, and being composed in mind, believed that which he had heard to be true. And he shows that his love towards Joseph had not languished through length of time, inasmuch as he set no value upon his own life, except so far as it would permit him to enjoy a sight of Joseph. He had before assigned to himself continual sorrow, even to the grave, but now he declares that he shall have a joyful death. Chapter 46, verse 1. And Israel took his journey. Because the holy man is compelled to leave the land of Canaan and to go elsewhere, he offers on his departure a sacrifice to the Lord for the purpose of testifying that the covenant which God had made with his fathers was confirmed and ratified to himself. For though he was accustomed to exercise himself in the external worship of God, there was yet a special reason for this sacrifice. And doubtless he had then peculiar need of support, lest his faith should fail, for he was about to be deprived of the inheritance promised to him, and of the sight of that land which was the type and pledge of the heavenly country. Might it not come into his mind that he had hitherto been deluded with a vain hope? Therefore, by renewing the memory of the divine covenant, he applies a suitable remedy against falling from the faith. For this reason, he offers a sacrifice on the very boundaries of that land, as I have just said, that we might know it to be something more than usual. And he presents this worship to God, to the God of his fathers, to testify that although he is departing from that land into which Abram had been called, yet he does not thereby cut himself off from the God in whose worship he had been educated. It was truly a remarkable proof of constancy that when cast out by famine into another region, so that he might not even be permitted to sojourn in the land of which he was the lawful lord, he yet retains, deeply impressed on his mind, the hope of his hidden right. It was not without subjecting himself to odium that he differed openly from other nations, by worshipping the God of his fathers. But what profit was there in having a religion different from all others? Seeing then he does not repent of having worshipped the God of his fathers, and that he now also perseveres in fear and reverence towards him, we hence infer how deeply he was rooted in true piety. By offering a sacrifice, he both increases his own strength and makes profession of his faith, because although piety is not bound to external simples, yet he will not neglect those helps, the use of which he has found to be by no means superfluous. Verse 2, and God spake unto Israel. In this manner God proves that the sacrifice of Jacob was acceptable to him, and again stretches out his hand to ratify anew his covenant. The vision by night availed for the purpose of giving greater dignity to the oracle. Jacob, indeed, inasmuch as he was docile and ready to yield obedience to God, did not need to be impelled by force and terror. Yet because he was a man encompassed with flesh, it was profitable for him that he should be affected with the glory of a present God, in order that the word might penetrate more effectually into his heart. It is, however, proper to recall to memory what I have said before, that the word was joined with it, because a silent vision would have profited little or nothing. We know that superstition eagerly snatches at mere spectres, by which means it presents God in a form of its own. But since no living image of God can exist without the word, whenever God has appeared to his servants, he has also spoken to them. Wherefore, in all outward signs, let us be ever attentive to his voice, if we would not be deluded by the wiles of Satan. But if those visions in which the majesty of God shines require to be animated by the word, then they who obtrude signs, invented at the will of men upon the church, exhibit nothing else than the empty pomps of a profane theatre. Just as in the papacy, those things which are called sacraments are lifeless phantoms which draw away deluded souls from the true God. Let this mutual connection, then, be observed, that the vision which gives greater dignity to the word precedes it, and that the word follows immediately, as if it were the soul of the vision. And there is no question that this was an appearance of the visible glory of God, which did not leave Jacob in suspense and hesitation, but which, by removing his doubt, firmly sustained him, so that he confidently embraced the oracle. Verse 3. Jacob, Jacob. The design of the repetition was to render him more attentive, for by thus familiarly addressing him, God more gently insinuates himself into his mind. As in the scripture, he kindly allures us, that he may prepare us to become his disciples. The docility of the holy man appears hence, that as soon as he is persuaded that God speaks, he replies that he is ready to receive with reverence whatever may be spoken, to follow wherever he may be called, and to undertake whatever may be commanded. Afterwards, a promise is added, by which God confirms and revives the faith of his servant. Whereas the descent into Egypt was to him a sad event, he is bidden to be of good and cheerful mind, inasmuch as the Lord would always be his helper, his keeper, and after having increased him there to a great nation, would bring him back again to the place whence he is now compelled to depart. And indeed Jacob's chief consolation turned on this point, that he should not perpetually wander up and down as an exile, but should, at length, enjoy the expected inheritance. For since the possession of the land of Canaan was the token of the divine favour, of spiritual blessings, and of eternal felicity, if holy Jacob was defrauded of this, it would have availed him little or nothing to have riches and all kinds of wealth and power heaped upon him in Egypt. The return promised him is not, however, to be understood of his own person, but refers to his posterity. Now as Jacob, relying on the promise, is commanded boldly to go down into Egypt, so it is the duty of all the pious, after his example, to derive such strength from the grace of God, that they may gird themselves to obey his commands. The title by which God here distinguishes himself is attached to the former oracles which Jacob had received by tradition from his fathers. But why does he not rather call himself the creator of heaven and earth than the God of Isaac or of Abraham? Except for this reason, that the dominion over the land of Canaan depends on the previous covenant, which he now ratifies anew. At the same time also, he encourages his servant by examples drawn from his own family, lest he should cease to proceed with constancy in his calling. For when he had seen that his father Isaac, and had heard that his grandfather Abraham, though long surrounded by great troubles, never gave way to any temptations, it ill became him to be overcome by weariness in the same course. Especially since, in the act of dying, they handed their lamp to their posterity, and took diligent care to leave the light of their faith to survive them in their family. In short, Jacob is taught that he must not seek, in crooked and diverse paths, that God, whom he had learned from his childhood to regard as the ruler of the family of Abraham, provided it did not degenerate from his piety. Moreover, we have elsewhere stated how far, in this respect, the authority of the fathers ought to prevail. For it was not the design of God, either that Jacob should subject himself to men, or should approve, without discrimination, whatever was handed down from his ancestors, seeing that he so often condemns in the Jews a foolish imitation of their fathers. But his design was to keep Jacob in the true knowledge of himself. Verse 4. And Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. This clause was added for the sake of showing greater indulgence. For though Jacob, in desiring that when he died, his eyes should be closed by the hand of Joseph, showed that some infirmity of the flesh was involved in the wish, yet God is willing to comply with it for the sake of moderating the grief of a fresh banishment. Moreover, we know that the custom of closing the eyes was of the greatest antiquity, and that this office was discharged by one most closely connected with the deceased, either by blood or affection. Verse 5. And Jacob rose up. By using the words rose up, Moses seems to denote that Jacob received new vigour from the vision. For although the former promises were not forgotten, yet the addition of the recent memorial came most opportunely, in order that he, bearing the land of Canaan in his heart, might endure his absence from it with equanimity. When it is said that he took with him all that he had acquired or possessed in the land of Canaan, it is probable that his servants and handmaids came together with his cattle. But on his departure no mention is made of them. Nay, a little afterwards, when Moses enumerates the separate heads of each tribe, he says that only 70 souls came with him. Should anyone say that Jacob had been compelled to liberate his slaves on account of the famine, or that he lost them through some misfortune to us unknown, the conjecture is unsatisfactory, for it is most incredible that he, who had been an industrious master of a family, and had abounded in the earthly blessings of God, should have become so entirely destitute that not even one little servant remained to him. It is more probable that, when the children of Israel were themselves employed in servile works, they were then deprived of their servants in Egypt, or at least a sufficient number was not left them to inspire them with confidence in any enterprise. And although, in the account of their deliverance, Moses is silent respecting their servants, yet it may be easily gathered from other passages that they did not depart without servants. Verse 8. These are the names of the children of Israel. He recounts the sons and grandsons of Jacob till he arrives at their full number. The statement that they were 70 souls, while Stephen, Acts 17 verse 14, adds 5 more, is made, I doubt not, by an error of the transcribers. For the solution of Augustine is weak, that Stephen, by a prolepsis, enumerates also three who afterwards were born in Egypt, for he must then have formed a far longer catalogue. Again, this interpretation is repugnant to the design of the Holy Spirit, as we shall hereafter see, because the subject here treated of is not respecting the number of children Jacob left behind him at his death, but respecting the number of his family on the day when he went down into Egypt. He is said to have brought with him, or to have found there, 70 souls born unto him, in order that the comparison of this very small number with that immense multitude which the Lord afterwards led forth might the more fully illustrate his wonderful benediction. But that the error is to be imputed to the transcribers is hence apparent, that with the Greek interpreters it has crept only into one passage, while elsewhere they agree with the Hebrew reckoning. And it was easy, when numerals were signified by marks, for one passage to be corrupted. I suspect also that this happened from the following cause, that those who had to deal with the scripture were generally ignorant of the Hebrew language, so that, conceiving the passage in the Acts to be vitiated, they rashly changed the true number. If anyone, however, chooses rather to suppose that Luke, in this instance, accommodating himself to the rude and illiterate, who were accustomed to the Greek version, I do not contend with them. In the words of Moses there is indeed no ambiguity, nor is there any reason why so small a number, in which there is no absurdity, should give us any trouble. For it is not wonderful that in the mode of notation one letter should have been put in the place of another. It is more to the purpose to examine wherefore this small number of persons is recorded by Moses. For the more improbable it appears that 70 men, in no lengthened space of time, should have grown to such a multitude, so much the more clearly does the grace of God shine forth. And this is also the reason why he so frequently mentions his number. For it was, by no means, according to human apprehension, a likely method of propagating the church, that Abraham should live childless even to old age, that after the death of Isaac, Jacob alone should remain, that he, being increased with a moderate family, should be shut up in a corner of Egypt, and that there is an incredible number of people should spring up from this dry fountain. When Moses declares that Shaul, one of the sons of Simon, was born of a Canaanitish woman, while he does not even mention the mothers of the other sons, his intention, I doubt not, is to fix a mark of dishonour on his race. For the Holy Fathers were on their guard not to mix in marriage with that nation, from which they were separated by the decree of heaven. When Moses, having put down the names of Leah's sons, says there were 33 souls, whereas he has only mentioned 22, I understand that Jacob himself is to be reckoned the first in order. The statement that he had so many sons or daughters by Leah does not oppose this conclusion, for although, strictly speaking, his discourse is concerning sons, yet he commences with the head of the family. I reject the interpretation of the Hebrews, who suppose Jochebed, the mother of Moses, to be included, as being overstrained. A question suggests itself concerning the daughters, whether they were more than two. If Dinah alone were named, it might be said that express mention was made of her, because of the notorious fact which had happened to her. But since Moses enumerates another female in the progeny of Asher, I rather conjecture that these had remained unmarried or single, for no mention is made of those who were wives. Verse 28. And he sent Judah before him unto Joseph. Because Goshen had been selected by Joseph as the abode of his father and his brethren, Jacob now desires that, on his coming, he may find the place prepared for him, for the expression which Moses uses implies that he requires a house to be built and furnished for him, but only that he may be permitted there to pitch his tent without molestation. for it was necessary that some unoccupied place should be assigned him, lest he, taking possession of the pastures or fields of the inhabitants, he might give them an occasion for exciting a tumult. In the meeting of Jacob with his son Joseph, Moses describes their vehement feeling of joy to show that the Holy Fathers were not destitute of natural affection. It must, however, be remembered that, although the affections spring from good principles, yet they always contract some evil from the corrupt propensity of the flesh, and have chiefly this fault, that they always exceed their bounds, whence it follows that they do not need to be eradicated, but to be kept within due bounds. Verse 31, I will go up and show Pharaoh. After Joseph had gone forth to meet his father for the purpose of doing him honour, he also provides what will be useful for him. On this account, he advises Jacob to declare that he and all his family were keepers of cattle, to the end that he might obtain from the king a dwelling place for them in the land of Goshen. Now, although his moderation deserves commendation on the ground that he usurps no authority to himself, but that, as one of the common people, he awaits the pleasure of the king, he yet may be thought craftily to devise a pretext by which he might circumvent the king. We see what he desired. Seeing that the land of Goshen was fertile and celebrated for its rich pastures, this advantage so allured his mind that he wished to fix his father there. But then, keeping out of Pharaoh's sight the richness of the land, he puts forth another reason, namely that Jacob with his sons were men held in abomination, and that therefore he was seeking a place of seclusion in which they might dwell apart from the Egyptians. It is not, however, very difficult to untie this knot. The fertility of the land of Goshen was so fully known to the king that no room was left for fraud or calming, though kings are often too profuse and foolishly waste much, because they know not what they grant. Yea, Pharaoh, of his own accord, had offered them unsolicited the best and choicest place in the kingdom. Therefore, this bounty of his was not elicited from him by stratagem, because he was free to form his own judgment respecting what he would give. And truly Joseph, in order that he might act modestly, felt it necessary to seek a habitation in Goshen on this pretext, for it would have been absurd, or at least inconsiderate, for men who were obscure and strangers to desire an abode in the best and most convenient place for themselves, as if they possessed a right to choose for themselves. Joseph, therefore, having regard to his own modesty and that of his father, adduces another cause, which was yet a true one. For seeing that the Egyptians held the occupation of shepherds in abhorrence, he explains to the king that this would be a suitable retreat for his brethren. Herein was no dissimulation, because in no other place was a quiet habitation accessible to them. Nevertheless, it was hard for the Holy Fathers to be thus opprobriously rejected, and as it were to be loathed by the whole nation. Yet this ignominy with which they were branded was most profitable to themselves, for had they been mingled with the Egyptians, they might have been scattered far and wide. But now, seeing they were objects of detestation, and are thought unworthy to be admitted to common society, they learn, in this state of separation from others, to cherish more fervently mutual union between themselves. And thus the body of the church, which God has set apart from the whole world, is not dispersed. So the Lord often permits us to be despised or rejected by the world, that being liberated and cleansed from its pollution, we may cultivate holiness. Finally, he does not suffer us to be bound by chains to the earth, in order that we may be borne upward to heaven. Chapter 47, verse 1. Then Joseph came. Joseph indirectly intimates to the king his desire to obtain a habitation for his brethren in the land of Goshen. Yet this modestly was, as we have said, free from cunning, for Pharaoh both immediately recognizes his wish and liberally grants it to him, declaring beforehand that the land of Goshen was most excellent, whence we gather that what he gave in the exercise of his own judgment, not in ignorance, and that he was not unacquainted with the wish of Joseph, who yet did not dare to ask for what was the best. Joseph may be easily excused for having commanded his father, with the greater part of his brethren, to remain in that region. For neither was it possible for them to bring their cattle along with them, nor yet to leave their cattle in order to come and salute the king, until some settled abode was assigned them, where, having pitched their tents, they might arrange their affairs. For it would have shown a want of respect to take possession of a place, as if it had been granted to them, when they had not yet received the permission of the king. They therefore remain in that district in a state of suspense, until, having ascertained the will of the king, they may with greater certainty fix their abode there. That Joseph brought five from the extreme limits of his brethren is commonly thus explained, that they who were of the least stature were brought into the presence of the king, because it was to be feared lest he might take the stronger into his army. But since the Hebrew word katsar signifies the two extremities, the beginning and the end, I think they were chosen from the first and the last, in order that the king, by looking at them, might form his judgment concerning the age of the whole. Verse 3. The servants were shepherds. This confession was humiliating to the sons of Jacob, and especially to Joseph himself, whose high and almost regal dignity was thus marked with a spot of disgrace. For among the Egyptians, as we have said, this kind of life was disgraceful and infamous. Why then did not Joseph adopt the course, which he might easily have done, of describing his brethren as persons engaged in agriculture or any other honest and creditable method of living? They were not so addicted to the feeding of cattle as to be altogether ignorant of agriculture, or incapable of accustoming themselves to other modes of gaining a livelihood. And although they would not immediately have found it productive, we see how ready the liberality of the king was to help them. Indeed, it would not have been difficult for them to become invested with offices at court. How then does it happen that Joseph, knowingly and purposely, exposes his brethren to ignominy, which must bring dishonor unto himself, except because he was not very anxious to escape from worldly contempt? To live in splendour among the Egyptians would have had at first a plausible appearance, but his family would have been placed in a dangerous position. Now, however, their mean and contemptible mode of lives proves a wall of separation between them and the Egyptians. Yea, Joseph seems purposely to labour to cast off in a moment the nobility he had acquired, that his own posterity might not be swallowed up in the population of Egypt, but might rather merge in the body of his ancestral family. If, however, this consideration did not enter their minds, there is no doubt that the Lord directed their tongues so as to prevent the noxious admixture and keep the body of the church pure and distinct. This passage also teaches us how much better it is to possess a remote corner in the courts of the Lord than to dwell in the midst of palaces beyond the precincts of the church. Therefore, let us not think it grievous to secure a sacred union with the sons of God by enduring the contempt and reproaches of the world, even as Joseph preferred this union to all the luxuries of Egypt. But if anyone thinks he cannot otherwise serve God in purity than by rendering himself disgusting to the world, away with all this folly. The design of God was this, to keep the sons of Jacob in a degraded position, until he should restore them to the land of Canaan, for the purpose then of preserving themselves in unity till the promised deliverance should take place, They did not conceal the fact that they were shepherds. We must beware, therefore, lest the desire of empty honour should elate us, whereas the Lord reveals no other way of salvation than out of bringing us under discipline. Wherefore, let us willingly be without honour for a time, that hereafter angels may receive us to a participation of their eternal glory. By this example also, they who are brought up in humble employments are taught that they have no need to be ashamed of their lot. It ought to be enough, and more than enough, for them, that the mode of living which they pursue is lawful and acceptable to God. The remaining confession of the brethren, Genesis 47 verse 4, was not unattended with a sense of shame, in which they say that they had come to sojourn there, compelled by hunger, but hence arose advantage not to be despised. For as they came down few, and perishing with hunger, and so branded with infamy, that scarcely any one would deign to speak with them, the glory of God afterwards shone so much the more illustriously out of this darkness, when in the third century, from that time, he wonderfully led them forth, a mighty nation. Verse 5. And Pharaoh spake unto Joseph, It is to be ascribed to the favour of God that Pharaoh was not offended when they desired that a separate dwelling place might be granted to them. For we know that nothing is more indignantly borne by kings than that their favours should be rejected. Pharaoh offers them a perpetual home, but they rather wish to depart from him. Should anyone ascribe this to modesty on the ground that it would have been proud to ask for the right of citizenship in order that they might enjoy the same privileges as natives, the suggestion is indeed plausible. It is, however, fallacious, for in asking to be admitted as guests and strangers, they took timely precaution that Pharaoh should not hold them bound in the chains of servitude. The passage of Sophocles is known. Who refuge seeks within a tyrant's door, when she enters there, is free no more? It was therefore of importance to the sons of Jacob to declare in limine on what condition they wished to live in Egypt. And so much the more inexcusable was the cruelty exercised towards them, when in violation of this compact they were most severely oppressed, and were denied their opportunity of departure from which they had stipulated. Joseph, in Isaiah indeed, says that the king of Egypt had some pretext for his conduct, because the sons of Jacob had voluntarily placed themselves under his authority, Isaiah 52 verse 4. But he is speaking comparatively, in order that he may the more graciously accuse the Assyrians, who had invaded the posterity of Jacob, when they were quiet in their own country, and expelled them thence by unjust violence. Therefore the law of hospitality was wickedly violated when the Israelites were oppressed as slaves, and when they returned into their own country, for which they had silently covenanted, was denied them. Though they had professed that they had come thither as guests, for the fidelity and humanity ought to have been exercised towards them by the king, when once they were received under his protection. It appears, therefore, that the children of Israel so guarded themselves, as in the presence of God, that they had just ground of complaint against the Egyptians. But seeing that the pledge given them by the king proved of no advantage to them according to the flesh, let the faithful learn from their example to train themselves to patience. For it commonly happens that he who enters the court of a tyrant is under the necessity of laying down his liberty at the door. Verse 6. The land of Egypt. This is recorded not only to show that Jacob was courteously received, but also that nothing was given him by Joseph, but at the command of the king. For the greater was his power, the more strictly was he bound to take care less liberal with the king's property, he might defraud both him and his people. And I would that this moderation so prevailed among the nobles of the world that they would conduct themselves in their private affairs no otherwise than if they were plebeians. But now they seem to themselves to have no power unless they may prove it by license to sin. And although Joseph, by the king's permission, places his family amidst the best pastures, yet he does not avail himself of the other portion of the royal beneficence to make his brethren keepers of the king's cattle, not only because his privilege would have excited the envy of many against them, but because he was unwilling to be entangled with such a snare. Verse 7. And Joseph brought in Jacob his father. Although Moses relates, in a continuous narrative, that Jacob was brought to the king, yet I do not doubt that some time had intervened, at least till he had obtained a place wherein he might dwell, and where he might leave his family more safely and with a more tranquil mind, and also where he might refresh himself for a little while after the fatigue of his journey. And whereas he is said to have blessed Pharaoh, by this term Moses does not mean a common and profane salutation, but the pious and holy prayer of a servant of God. For the children of this world salute kings and princes for the sake of honour, but by no means raise their thoughts to God. Jacob acts otherwise, for he adjoins to civil reverence that pious affection which causes him to commend the safety of the king to God. And Jeremiah prescribes his rule to the Jews, that they should pray for the peace of Babylon as long as they were to live in exile, because in the peace of that land and empire, their own peace would be involved. Jeremiah 29, verse 7. If this duty was enjoined on miserable captives, forcibly deprived of their liberty and torn from their own country, how much more did Jacob owe it to a king so humane and beneficent? But of whatever character they may be who rule over us, we are commanded to offer up public prayers for them. 1 Timothy 2:1. Therefore the same subjection to authority is required severally from each of us. Verse 8. How old art thou? This familiar question proves that Jacob was received courteously and without ceremony. But the answer is of far greater moment, in which Jacob declares that the time of his pilgrimage was 130 years. For the apostle, in his epistle to the Hebrews, Hebrews 11:13-16, gathers hence the memorable doctrine that God was not ashamed to be called the God of the patriarchs, because they had confessed themselves to be strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Of one man only this is mentioned, but because he had been instructed by his forefathers, and had handed down the same instruction to his son, the apostle honours them all with the same eulogy. Therefore, as they were not ashamed to wander during the whole course of their life, and to be opprobriously called foreigners and strangers wherever they came, so God vouchsafed to them the incomparable dignity that they should be heirs of heaven. But, as it has been said before, no persons ever had a more peculiar and hereditary possession in the world than the holy fathers had in the land of Canaan. The Lord is said to have cast his line in order that he might assign to each nation its bounds. But any eternal possession through a continual succession of ages was never promised to any nation as it was to the posterity of Abraham. In what spirit, then, ought we to dwell in a world where no certain repose or fixed abode is promised us? Moreover, this is described by Paul as the common condition of all pious persons under the reign of Christ, that they should have no certain dwelling place. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 11. Not that all should be alike cast out as exiles, but because the Lord calls all his people, as by the sound of the trumpet, to be wanderers, lest they should become fixed in their nests on earth. Therefore, whether any whether anyone remains in his own country or is compelled continually to change his place, let him diligently exercise himself in the meditation that he is sojourning for a short time upon earth, till having completed his course, he shall depart to the heavenly country. Verse 9. Few and evil have been the days and the years of my life been. Jacob may here seem to complain that he had lived but a little while, and that in this short space of time he had endured many and grievous afflictions. Why does he not rather recount the great and manifold favours of God, which formed an abundant compensation for every kind of evil? Because his complaint, respecting the shortness of life, seems unworthy of him, for why did he not deem a whole century and a third part of another sufficient for him? But if anyone will rightly weigh his words, he rather expresses his own gratitude in celebrating the goodness of God towards his fathers. For he does not so much deplore his own decrepitude as he extols the vigour divinely afforded to his fathers. Certainly it was no new and unwonted thing to see a man at his age broken down and failing, and already near to the grave. Wherefore this comparison, as I have said, was only intended to ascribe glory to God, whose blessing towards Abraham and Isaac had been greater than to himself. But he does not compare himself with his fathers in suffering, as if they had been treated with greater indulgence, for we know that they had been tried to the utmost with all kinds of temptations. He merely states that he had not attained their age, as if he had said, "I indeed have arrived at those years which, by others, is deemed a mature old age, and which complete the proper term of life. But the Lord so prolonged the life of my fathers that they far exceeded this limit." He makes mention of evil days in order to show that he was not so much broken down and consumed by years as by labours and troubles, as if he had said, "My senses might yet have flourished in their vigour, if my strength had not been exhausted by continual labours, by excessive cares, or by most grievous sufferings." We now see that nothing was less in the mind of the holy man than to expostulate with God, yet it may seem absurd that he speaks of his life as being shorter than that of his fathers. For whence does he conjecture that so little time should still remain for him as to prevent him from attaining their age? Should anyone answer that he formed this conjecture from the weakness of his body, which was half dead, the solution will not prove satisfactory. For Isaac had dimness of sight and trembling limbs 30 years before his death. But it is not absurd to suppose that Jacob was every moment giving himself over to death, as if the sepulchre were before his eyes. He was, however, uncertain what length of time was decreed for him in the secret counsel of God. Wherefore, being unconcerned about the remainder of his life, he speaks just as if he were about to die on the next day. Verse 12. And Joseph nourished his father, etc., according to their families. Some explain the expression, "the mouth of the little one," as if Joseph nourished his father and his whole family in a manner in which food is conveyed to the mouths of children. These interpreters regard the former speech as emphatical, because during the famine, Jacob and his family had no more anxiety about the providing of food than children, who cannot even stretch out their hand to receive it. Others translate it "youth," but I know not with what meaning. Others take it simply according to the proportion and number of the little children. To me, the genuine sense seems to be that he fed all, from the greatest to the least. Therefore, there was sufficient bread for the whole family of Jacob, because by the care of Joseph, provision was made to supply nourishment even to the little ones. In this manner, Moses commemorates both the clemency of God and the piety of Joseph, for it was an instance of uncommon attention at these hungry husbandmen who had not a grain of corn were entirely fed at his expense. Verse 13. And all the land of Canaan fainted. It was a memorable judgment of God that the most fertile regions, which were accustomed to supply provisions for distant and transmarine nations, were reduced to such poverty that they were almost consumed. The word lahar, which Moses uses, is explained in two ways. Some say that they were driven to madness on account of the famine. Others that they were so destitute of food that they fainted. But whichever method of interpretation be approved, we see that they who had been accustomed to supply others with food were themselves famishing. Therefore, it is not for those who cultivate fertile lands to trust in their abundance. Rather, let them acknowledge that a large supply of provision does not so much spring from the bowels of the earth as it distills, or rather flows down from heaven by the secret blessing of God. For there is no luxuriance so great that it is not soon exchanged for barrenness when God sprinkles it with salt instead of rain. Meanwhile, it is right to turn our eyes to that special kindness of God by which he nourishes his own people in the midst of famine, as it is said in Psalm 37, verse 19. If, however, God is pleased to try us with famine, we must pray that he would prepare us to endure hunger with a meek and equal mind, lest we should rage like fierce and even ravenous wild beasts. And although it is possible that grievous commotions were raised during the protracted scarcity, as is said in the old proverb that the belly has no ears, yet the more simple sense of the passage seems to me to be that the Egyptians and Canaanites had sunk under the famine and were lying prostrate as if at the point of death. Moreover, Moses pursues the history of the famine with the intention of showing that the prediction of Joseph was verified by the event, and that by his skill and industry, the greatest dangers were so well and dexterously provided against that Egypt ought justly to acknowledge him as the author of its deliverance. Verse 14. And Joseph gathered up all the money. Moses first declares that the Egyptian king had acted well and wisely in committing the work of providing corn to the sole care and authority of Joseph. He then commends the sincere and faithful administration of Joseph himself. We know how few persons can touch the money of kings without defiling themselves by peculation. Amid such vast heaps of money, the opportunity of plundering was not less than the difficulty of self-restraint. But Moses says that whatever money Joseph collected, he brought into the house of the king. It was a rare and unparalleled integrity to keep the hands pure amid such heaps of gold, and he would not have been able to conduct himself with such moderation unless his divine calling had proved as a bridle to hold him in. For they who are restrained from thefts and rapaciousness by worldly motives alone would immediately put forth their hand to the prey unless they feared the eyes and judgments of men. But inasmuch as Joseph might have sinned without a witness of his fault, it follows that the true fear of God flourished in his breast. Plausible and well-coloured pretexts in excuse of the theft would doubtless present themselves. When you are serving a tyrant, why may it not be lawful for you to apply some part of the gain to your own advantage? So much the more does it appear that he was fortified by downright honesty, since he repelled all temptations, lest he should desire fraudulently to enrich himself at the expense of another. Verse 15. And when the money failed, Moses does not mean that all the money in Egypt had been brought into the royal treasury, for there were many of the nobles of the court free from the effects of the famine. But the simple meaning of the expression is that nearly all had been exhausted, that now the common people had not money enough to buy corn, and that at length extreme necessity had driven the Egyptians to the second remedy of which he is about to speak. Moreover, although like persons driven to desperation, they might seem arrogantly to rise up against Joseph, yet the context shows that nothing was further from their minds than to terrify, by their boldness, the man whose compassion they suppliantly implore. Wherefore the question, why should we die in thy presence, has no other signification than that they felt themselves ruined unless his clemency should afford them relief. But it may be asked how the Canaanites supported their lives. There is indeed no doubt that a grievous pestilence, the attendant on famine, would have carried off many unless they received assistance from other regions or were miserably fed on herbs and roots. And perhaps the barrenness was not there so great, but that they might gather half or a third part of their food from the fields. Verse 16. Give your cattle. It was a miserable spectacle, and one which might have softened hearts of iron, to see rich farmers, who previously had kept provision stored in their granaries for others, now begging food. Therefore Joseph might be deemed cruel, because he does not give bread gratuitously to those who are poor and exhausted, but robs them of all their cattle, sheep and asses. Seeing, however, that Joseph is transacting the business of another, I dare not charge his strictness with cruelty. If during the 7 fruitful years he had extorted corn by force from an unwilling people, he would now have acted tyrannically in seizing their flocks and herbs. But seeing that they had been at liberty to lay up in their private stores what they had sold to the king, they now pay the just penalty of their negligence. Joseph also perceived that they were deprived of their possessions by a divine interposition, in order that the king alone might be enriched by the spoils of all. Besides, since it was lawful for him to offer corn for sale, it was also lawful for him to exchange it for cattle. Truly the corn belonged to the king. Why then should he not demand a price from the purchasers? But they were poor, and therefore it was but just to succour them in their want. Were this rule to prevail, the greater part of sales would be unlawful, for no one freely parts with what he possesses. Wherefore, if his valuation of the cattle was fair, I do not see what was deserving of reprehension in the conduct of Joseph, especially as he was not dealing with his own property. He had been appointed prefect over the corn, with this condition, that he should acquire gain not for himself but for the king. If anyone should object that he ought at least to exhorted the lying to content to himself with the abundant pecuniary wealth which he had obtained, I answer that Moses relates, by the way, but a few things out of many. Anyone, therefore, may easily conjecture that a business of such great consequence was not transacted by Joseph without the cognizance and judgment of the king. But what if it appeared to the king's counsellors an equitable arrangement that the farmers should receive, in return for their cattle, food for the whole year? Lastly, seeing that we stand or fall by the judgment of God alone, it is not for us to condemn what his law has left undecided. Verse 18. They came to him the second year. Moses did not reckon the second year from the date of the famine, but from the time when the money had failed. But since they knew from the oracle that the termination of the dearth was growing near, they desired not only that corn should be given them for food, but also for seed, whence it appears that they had become wise too late, and had neglected the useful admonition of God at the time when they ought to have made provision for the future. Moreover, when they declare that their money and cattle had failed, they do it not for the purpose of expostulating with Joseph, as if they had been unjustly deprived of these things by him, but for the purpose of showing that the only thing remaining for them was to purchase food and seed at the price of their lands, and that they could not otherwise be preserved unless Joseph would enter into this compact. For it would have been the part of imprudence to offer no price or compensation. They begin by saying that they had nothing at hand, and that therefore their lives would be lost, unless Joseph were willing to buy their lands, and in order to excite his compassion, they ask again why he should suffer them to die, and their very land to perish. For this is the death of the earth, when the cultivation of it is neglected, and when, being reduced to a desert, it can bring forth nothing more. Verse 20. And Joseph bought all the land. Anyone might suppose it to be the height of cruel and inexplicable avarice that Joseph should take away from the miserable husbandmen the very fields by the produce of which they nourished the kingdom. But I have before showed that unless every kind of purchase is to be condemned, there is no reason why Joseph should be blamed. If anyone should say that he abused their penury, this alone would suffice for his excuse, that no wiles of his, no circumvention, no force, no threats, had reduced the Egyptians to this necessity. He transacted the king's business with equal fidelity and industry, and fulfilled the duties of his office without resorting to violent edicts. When the famine became urgent, it was lawful to expose wheat to sale, as well as to the rich as to the poor. Afterwards it was not less lawful to buy the cattle. And now at last, why should it not be lawful to acquire the land for the king at a just price? To this may be added that he extorted nothing, but entered into treaty with them at their own request. I confess, indeed, that it is not right to take whatever may be offered without discrimination. For if severe necessity presses, then he who wishes by all means to escape it will submit to hard conditions. Therefore, when any one thus invites us to defraud him, we are not by his necessities rendered excusable. But I do not defend Joseph on this sole ground, that the Egyptians voluntarily offered him their lands, as men who were ready to purchase life at any price. But I say this ought also to be considered, that he acted with equity, even though he left them nothing. The terms would have been more severe if they themselves had been consigned to perpetual slavery. But he now concedes to them personal liberty, and only covenants for their fields, which perhaps the greater part of the people had bought from the poor. If he had stripped of their clothing those whom he was feeding with corn, this would have been to them indirectly and slowly to death. For what difference did it make, whether I compel a man to die by hunger or by cold? But Joseph so succours the Egyptians that in future they should be free, and should be able to obtain a moderate subsistence by their labour. For though they might have to change their abode, yet they are all made stewards of the king, and Joseph restores to them not only the lands, but the implements which he had bought. Whence it appears that he had used what clemency he was able in order to relieve them. Meanwhile, let those who are too intent on wealth beware lest they should falsely employ Joseph's example as a pretext, because it is certain that all contracts which are not formed according to the rule of charity are vicious in the sight of God, and that we ought, according to that equity which is inwardly dictated to us by a secret instinct of nature, so to act towards others as we wish to be dealt with ourselves. This recording ends on page 720.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at PuritanDownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at PuritanDownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwater's Revival Books.